This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
On our post-budget 2017 panel, may I welcome Ng Yin Sin, the Vice President of the Reform Advocacy Group SENBET, which stands for Centre for Better Tomorrow, and Jagdev Singh, the Tax Leader for PricewaterhouseCoopers Malaysia, PwC. Lady and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Now, having had the benefit of this weekend to ruminate and analyse the complexities of the budget, let's dive straight into the issues and begin with some specific issues such as the GST, considered in the context of the still narrow revenue base. How close, Jagdev, do you think we were to a government decision on a higher quantum of GST rates, given our dependence on that sector?
Thanks, Chuang. We only introduced GST about 18 months ago, and I think it is too soon for us to change the rates at this point in time. So if you look at the experience of the other countries, generally after introduction, people have held it constant for a number of years. Singapore is a good example. I think they held it constant for about 8 to 9 years before they sort of moved the rate up from 3% to 4%. So holding the rate at 6%, I think, is the right thing to do. Probably it'd be good if the government can give some guidance moving forward as to what the GST rates will look like over the longer term.
Well, of course, there's also the very tidy list of exemptions that also need to be cleaned up. Yin Sin, when you looked at the budget and you looked at it from a holistic standpoint, did you get the sense that this was overly focused on perhaps the masses as opposed to the business sector?
I think this time around, before the announcement, before Friday, many people were actually speculating that this is going to be an election budget, as many people, including myself, we are looking at election happening in 2017. So therefore, this is a budget. Of course, the budget for an election budget, whether Najib and the ministers would like to admit that whether it's going to be an election budget or not, it is an election budget to us, because as you correctly pointed out, it is to the masses. If you look through the budget cover to cover, you will realise that Prime Minister Najib actually touched on almost every community, especially the civil servants. So if I look at it from a political standpoint, I trust that he wants to win more votes from the civil service. Therefore, you see housing assistance, you see paid study leave, you see daycare services, you see a lot of goodies to the civil servants. So that's how even the servants have this big chunk of the goodie from the budget. To me, yes, it is an election budget, but it is also the people's budget, because a lot of emphasis has been given to the B40, especially to the rural community, and even to the SMEs. For the first time, SME has got tax breaks when they achieve more than a certain amount in their profit.
Well, on the SME side, it's a bit opaque in terms of the treatment. Still a little bit unclear there from the practical side. But Jagdev, when you looked at the budget, and when you examined the revenue streams, I think essentially the GST is one of them. A private corporation tax, of course, and as well as the oil complex. Do you think Malaysia is a little bit too reliant on these three tripods? On this tripod.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, about almost 80% of the government's revenue still comes from taxes, which is direct taxes and indirect taxes. I think with the introduction of GST, at least we've tried to sort of diversify away a little bit from over-reliance on direct taxes itself. But those numbers are still very large. And I think over time, we probably have to make some structural adjustments to sort of move away from that kind of reliance.
What kind of structural adjustments?
Probably looking at what are other sources of revenue that the government can tap on, investment income, that seems to be something which you see featuring quite prominently in a lot of other countries. But over here, we are seeing only about 20% of that. And even
investment income from what source, though, Jack? That's an interesting point you raised, but from what source? Where do you get a big enough pool of funds to get some investments income from?
It could be the government itself investing. So if you take Singapore, for example, I think they've got a very structured way where the government is putting aside money, investing, and then there are returns coming out of that. And that contributes to the government's revenue in quite a big way. So if you look at a lot of the other countries in the region, they do rely on taxes. I think you can't run away from that, and taxes is always a big source of revenue. But maybe a little bit of diversification will be good.
Well, the thing is, the Malaysian government can't do that because it's been an overly large focus, I guess, on you know, keeping or pacifying people in terms of the subsidies, in terms of the giveaways over the last few years. And Malaysia doesn't really have much room for the investment income perspective. I mean, even this year, you don't have that, you know, the wherewithal, I guess, to put aside some money, you know, for income.
Yeah, I think previously we did have probably a more decent level of other income, particularly coming from the dividends from Petronas. But given the oil price where it is today, that definitely has dropped off. And therefore, you see the shift back to the direct taxes and indirect taxes.
Yin Sin, when you looked at the BRIM as well, and you see the slightly higher allocation for BRIM, I think something in the order of 10 or 15% more. You know, conceptually, do you support this concept of helicopter money to people?
Fundamentally, I don't agree with BRIM, but yes, it helped people for a short while. But I think the government must be very careful as well, because once you start giving up BRIM and you're continuously giving it out year in, year out, people expect that. And then sooner or later, a privilege become an entitlement. So I think having to be dependent on cash handout, it's definitely not a long-term solution. And I think the government should, in fact, take on a regressive approach in terms of BRIM to slowly cut it down and to give assistance in other forms instead of just a cash handout.
Well, there are more ways of doing this. Of course, I think governments in the past have been accused of being too indirect with their handouts, you know, helping the banks, ensuring more money is pumped into the system, corporate sponsorship, essentially. Jagdev, but you've obviously got a view on BRIM, and you think that it should be bigger, but it must be conditional and, in fact, behavioural in a way.
If you look at BRIM, it was introduced in 2012, and it sort of coincided with, you know, the government reducing subsidies. So BRIM is definitely an excellent way of a more targeted approach, putting money into the pockets of the people who need it most. And I think over time that has increased and probably kept up with the increases in costs and so on. Whether we should increase it, probably yes, but maybe in a more structured or more targeted manner. So, you know, a lot of these things drive behavior. And if you want people to behave in a certain way, then maybe BRIM should be structured to drive that behavior. For example, if you want to encourage people to use public transport, rather than giving it as cash, you give them a debit card or something that they can use on public transport. So that's maybe a better way of doing it. But on a bigger picture, my take on BRIM is, yes, it's the right thing to do, but you know, a measure of success for BRIM would be to see the number of people receiving it reduce over time, which means that we have put in sufficient structural changes to the economy and the incomes of people that the level of BRIM that, you know, the number of recipients for BRIM will actually reduce over time.
Well, Jagdev, you speak good sense, but, you know, this transitory element and governments managing that transition well is a difficult one. And Malaysia's government does not have a good track record. I mean, look at the NAP. We've been, you know, tussling with withdrawing it for the longest time, but we haven't done it elegantly. So, Yin Sin, you say that, you know, we can do this and we should manage this transition because you don't want people to depend on like the dole situation in the UK. So, you know, in your work at Sandbat, I'm sure you talk to the government. What kinds of dialogues do you have on this front?
I think the government is very persistent on giving up BRIM because government believe that, as what Jafdit has said, that BRIM is a cash and out, so therefore people can use it however way they want it. But from my perspective, if you look at the way how people have been spending the BRIM money, it is really sad because many people just use it as a one-off payment to buy a new mobile phone, to go and buy something that not necessarily help elevate their cost of living.
But well, it makes people happy, isn't it? It's like giving away candy, isn't it?
Exactly. So what you have just said, we have to slowly change behaviour. For example, we give people a rail card, a transit link card, we give people a bit of food voucher and things like that. Yes, those voucher kind of approach may link to corruption and leakages, and that's what's happening in many other countries. But that can be more targeted as well, and that will actually frame behaviour as in how you should be spending all this extra handout that's government giving to you, but not on any other big item that you so want to buy, or it could be a luxury item for a low income earner.
On our post-budget 2017 panel, we have with us Ng Yin Sin, the Vice President of SANBAD, which is the Reform Advocacy Group, as well as Jagdeep Singh, the Tax Leader for PwC Malaysia. After this, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking about the deficit, contingent liabilities and the fiscal side of things. Ng Yin Sin, the Vice President of SANBAD, and Jagdeep Singh, Tax Leader for PwC Malaysia, with us on the grill this morning discussing the budget 2017. Now, of course, in terms of specific tax issues, Jagdeep, we saw a whole clutch of things which are, I guess, quite beneficial to the masses and the M40s and B40s. We had certain stamp duty exemptions. We had certain lifestyle tax reliefs. We had certain issues with first-time car ownership and, you know, with regard to the Proton Iris, for example. These seem to be quite good for the rakyat in general. But from a conceptual standpoint as well, it does seem as if we're trying to put people into the ownership scheme, but at the expense, I guess, of their financial liberty in a way, because they're entering the debt into the banking system. Did you have a view on those issues, Jagdeep?
I think over time, there's been a lot of requests for reliefs to be increased. Tax reliefs to be increased. And I think, yes, we do have a very long list of reliefs, but maybe, you know, people still want more. So if you see the lifestyle tax relief that they've introduced, I think it's keeping up with times. So previously, if you buy a computer, you can take a deduction once every 3 years. And for those of you who plan to buy a computer and you haven't bought one or taken a deduction in the last 2 years, you should do so before end of this year. Because the clock gets reset back to zero come 2017. So to me, I think a lot of the changes have been sort of structured to keep up with times. But I think to your question whether some of these changes would result in people taking on additional debt, I don't think most of them will. Most of them are just, if somebody is going to buy a smartphone, for example.
Well, people with debt already, maybe the middle-aged guys, you know, like myself, we're already in the debt loop. But this is essentially targeted at the graduates and the young'uns.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, from a conceptual standpoint, do you think that it was actually good for the government to allow people to get into the debt cycle? Yin Sin?
I don't think the government is looking at it from the perspective of getting people into the debt cycle, but I think what the government is trying to do is to help younger people jumpstart in their career and their life after post-university. Like, you need to buy a computer, you need to perhaps get a car if you don't stay in the area where it's very well connected with public transport.
Well, there's half an argument in other jurisdictions around the world where you don't actually have to own a house or own a car or own a bicycle. You can just rent those things.
And I think that's why, how many, 10,000 new houses will be built and then for people to rent
for
and
rent,
all that.
Yeah.
I think those are new concepts for Malaysia that the government is trying to introduce, but certainly not new in other parts of the world. But I think it is also got to do with the Asian mentality that you have to own a house. If you don't own a house, you are such a loser. But in many parts of the world, people can rent. Maybe they rent until their age of 45 or even 50. And then when they save up, they have enough savings, then they can get their own home.
Well, perhaps in terms of the home ownership issue, that holds water. But then when it comes to vehicle ownership, it is not an asset. It's a depreciating liability.
Yeah.
Now, we saw specifically the Proton Iris being mentioned. You know, one got the impression that it was a little bit blatant in terms of the leniency it afforded to the auto sector. Nobody else got that treatment except for Proton, which is not even owned by the government anymore. It's owned by the private sector. Jagdeep?
I'm all for housing, and I think it is important that the government does more to make sure that people are able to afford houses. As far as cars are concerned, I think to me it's more of something that's optional, and trying to get the younger people or enticing them to buy a car by, you know, throwing in all these extras may not be something that may work very well, particularly if some of the youngsters cannot really manage their finances well.
We have with us Ng Yin Sin, the Vice President of the Reform Advocacy Group, SANBAD, on the grill this morning, as well as with Jagdeep Singh, the Tax Leader for PwC Malaysia. Now, one of the headline issues that were discussed by the media over the last couple of days has been this issue of the deficit targets, and I think we're trying to get the parity by 2020, and the government has actually said that we're going to be hitting 3.1% in 2016 and aiming for 3.0% in 2017. Now, from a fiscal standpoint, and let's start with you, Yin Sin. Mm-hmm. Do you think we can get, in fact, do you even think that, you know, 2016, 2017 can be considered as reform years because of the small reductions inherent?
I think if you look at put Malaysia on a world map and looking at it from a larger perspective, I think with our growth rate, we are doing pretty well considering most of the countries are having a growth rate of between 2 to 3%, and Malaysia, we still maintain at around 4.5%. I think in that sense, that is good because the Malaysian economy is also very much depending on how China is doing and the uncertainty in the US at the moment. So I think if we want to only look at Malaysia as in whether we are doing okay with our deficit or whether we are growing, we should also be looking at what can we do within the larger context. And I think for 2016, 2017, we will be okay with our 3.1% and 3% of budget deficit. But in my honest opinion, I don't think we can achieve a balanced budget in 2020. There may be a little bit of a pushback.
Okay, well, you know, obviously balancing the books makes up, it's comprised of two sides. Obviously, you've got to make more money and spend less money. And let's just examine some of the lines inside that, Jagdeep. When you look at things like GST, the assumption is 40 billion from 38.5 billion, I think. You've also got certain assumptions on the oil side. And I don't know what the price assumptions are there.
It's $45 per barrel.
Mentioned in the budget, yeah?
Not mentioned in the budget, but I found out. It's $45
Well, that's
barrel.
The problem, you see, the asymmetry of information between what the public sector know and what the private sector know. So we don't have that set in stone, Yinsin. So, these are the things that I guess, you know, the ratings agencies are looking at and getting quite concerned about because we're trying to get to parity, but we don't know how we're going to get there. Ajakta?
So if you look at the income side of things, I think, Chung, you're right. There are a couple of areas where there's an expectation where government revenues will increase. And I think the petroleum income tax is one where there's an expectation of a 25% increase, which is indeed a big jump. And that entirely depends on the assumptions around oil price. So if your assumptions do not hold water, then there is a chance that you may not be able to achieve those numbers. Similarly, if you look at, you know, you mentioned GST, and I don't think we're being very aggressive about the increases in GST given, you know, the sentiments around consumer spending. But if you look at corporate income taxes, we're expecting an almost 10% increase in terms of corporate income taxes. And, you know, if you look at the growth in the underlying economy itself of about 4 to 5%, and, you know, if you look at the corporate results that, you know, companies have been releasing, we do not really see a big jump. And therefore, trying to achieve a 10% growth in terms of corporate tax revenues may be a little bit of a stretch.
Okay, let's take those issues one by one. Let's take the oil complex, for example. The recalibrated budget from February this year assumed oil prices at about $40 a barrel. Right now, we're trading about 49 odd for Brent, of course, being the benchmark. You say, Yinsin, $45. Okay. So in a way, do you think our assumptions and the fact that we're predicating a lot of our income basis on this unstable commodity remains a concern?
It is a concern, but it's a fact that we have to face. We are still very dependent on Petronas and our extractive industry to fund this country. But I think the government's move to introduce GST as a saviour last year was a correct move. If you look at the entire working population of Malaysia and the amount of people paying income tax, a broad-based tax as like GST is just going to be good for all of us.
Well, the alternative budget suggested that GST can be removed, I'm not sure how, and to be replaced by a stopper and at least a retardation of the leakages and wastages and corruption. Do you think those are, you know, practical considerations?
Put it in layman terms, how are you going to make money if all you do is you stop spending but you don't earn? It's just that.
Well, then brings us on to the point about corporate taxes, Jagdeep, because 10% suggests either earnings are rising by that amount or more companies are coming to the fore. Let's take this issue in terms of the collective, the CIA, I think that quite ominously termed agency that is supposed to collect data and to share information among agencies to basically get more tax dollar from corporations and I think individuals as well. What was your practical interpretation of the CIA?
No, I think it's the right move, and it's probably a little bit overdue. There's already a lot of collaboration because a couple of the new acts, for example, the Anti-Money Laundering Act, already gets these different agencies working together. But you know, to formalize this into this collection intelligence arrangement is a good thing. And you've got now the tax authorities, the customs authorities, and the Companies Commission sharing a lot more information. And in today's age of, you know, data analytics and so on, a lot of this information can be very powerful in trying to help close the tax gap. And again, if you look at it from a global perspective, there's already a lot of cross-border sharing of information happening, not only in terms of taxes, but even banking information and so on. So this is definitely something that is overdue and something that I think will play a role in trying to sort of increase the level of compliance and close the tax gap.
Well, you know, do you both feel that business might have been feeling a little bit miffed as a result of Budget 2017? Because not only do we not see a reduction in corporate taxes, we've also seen more concerted efforts to extract the tax dollar from them. In fact, I mean, this appears overtly a rakyat budget, but not really a business budget. Yunsen?
Well, because election is coming, it's the people's votes that counts.
Well, corporation tax is a big part of the tripod.
Yeah, corporation tax only affect the bosses. But you have more workers than bosses.
Jagdev, you're smiling.
I think you've got to balance the budget as well. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, whilst it may be the right thing to sort of maybe reduce corporate taxes or grant more breaks, etc., but that is going to be counterproductive when it comes to trying to balance the budget. So, yes, it's a reality. There is very little in there for the corporates.
It's political reality, I take it.
Okay, the other leg, of course, of the revenue stream scenario are the excise duties and basically the alcohol boys, the tobacco boys, as well as the car boys. Now, the alcohol boys and the tobacco boys have been hit, and quite vigorously so. On the car side, I guess less so as well. But it does seem as if to be coming under threat because of the energy-efficient vehicle scenario, whereby, you know, you don't pay excise duties if you qualify for clean cars. But that, again, as a corollary, as on the flip side, it's going to hurt revenue.
Yeah, it's hurting revenue, but I think the government is looking at the larger picture to look at environmental protection to ensure that we reduce our carbon footprint and all that. Hands are tied, so we have to pick and choose. We cannot work everything towards more revenue, balanced budget, but then we compromise on environment issues and all that. I think that's the right approach to give tax relief to environmentally friendly cars.
I think over time, you're not going to see excise duties increasing in a big way or contributing. The sin industries are already hit, and probably, you know, I don't think they can take a lot more. If you look at it today, you're paying like 40 cents in terms of excise duties per cigarette stick. And I don't think you can stretch that any further. But I think you're right. In terms of cars, which contribute quite a significant portion in terms of excise duties, over the longer term, you will see a downward trend, particularly if we do keep up with, you know, making sure that electric cars and hybrid cars are not subject to excise duties or are subject to reduced duties.
Well, exactly. You even see people like Audi and BMW and Mercedes now introducing EV cars, and they're
those
nicely.
Those are like EV cars.
Yeah, correct. So, I mean, just from a more holistic standpoint, do you think that business, feeling a bit miffed as they are, might take preemptive measures and perhaps, you know, pull up stakes and move elsewhere, or even, you know, maybe invest less in this country?
That's what we are already seeing. For example, Top Glove actually moved their manufacturing plant, or I would say they opened up another manufacturing plant in Thailand. It's really happening, not only because of taxes. I believe it also has got to do with our labour force, with our talent, and a lot of other material costs and all that.
Ng Yin Sin, the Vice President of the Reform Advocacy Group, Senbat, with us on the grill this morning, as well as Jagdev Singh, Tax Leader of PwC Malaysia. We've got more to discuss, especially on the structural issues like education and productivity, as well as our fiscal deficit targets after this, BFM 89.9. We have on the grill this morning Ng Yin Sin, the Vice President of the Reform Advocacy Group Senbat, as well as Jagdev Singh, the Tax Leader for PwC Malaysia. And we have both of them with us for the post-Budget 2017 panel. Now, both of you, it does seem as if Budget 2017 is a budget which is rather short-term in nature, as it has been the last couple of years at least, in terms of what has been doled out to the people and various stakeholders in the country. But too little, I think, by way of structural reform. And I'm going to refer specifically to the education sector and producing a productive, talented, hardworking workforce, which will obviously lend itself to higher incomes and higher individual taxes and better employees in corporations and, of course, better corporation taxes as well. Do you get the sense that structural issues, Jagdev, should have been better addressed and at least the ball should have started rolling better in this regard?
I think we've started a couple of things on education, which is in the right direction. So, for example, we started off a couple of years back with a focus on this technical and TVET. Vocational education and training, TVET, right? And that, to me, is a right way to go, because if you look at a lot of the developed nations, they... you know, measure of success is not whether you go to university, is whether you've got the right skill sets that the country and the economy needs. And by putting a lot more money into TVET is probably the right thing to do. So if you look at budget 2017, there's about 4.6 billion that is being put into TVET. And to me, that is a big structural shift that we are making. But that's probably one of the things that we are doing. And there is a lot more that we can do, particularly in trying to make sure that we have a workforce that meets the requirements of the economy.
Yinsen?
I think TVET actually was being introduced in the 11th Malaysia plan, and it came into kind of like full force last year in the 2016 budget. This year around, like what Jagdeep had said, we still have quite a big chunk of allocation to TVET in terms of education, if you want to lump education in as a whole. I also realised that the government is going to do some brownfield development in terms of revamping unused buildings into TVET centres and training centres for TVET. I think those are small moves for the nation to move to slowly embrace TVET graduates more in the future. Because as what he has said, that in many countries, achievement doesn't come in the forms of university degrees and all that. But I think with the Asian perspective and Asian mentality, one really need to go to a university to get your PhD, and then you are going to be qualified. That's how people define success in this in this region, unfortunately.
Well, is it too little too late? Because when you look at the numbers, for example, at a projected 16.6% of GDP in 2017, federal government revenue is going to be down for a fifth straight year from peak of 21.4% of GDP in 2012. So basically, the government is earning less money as a percentage of GDP and has been doing so for the last 5 years. Now, it means, therefore, that on a collective basis, we're not collecting enough revenue from taxes, individual corporations, as well as from the oil sector. Is this a trend, Jagdeep, that perhaps disturbs you?
I think it does. I mean, anyone will be concerned with that. And I think it's very difficult to sort of single that down to a single factor. But to me, I think the point on education then also links back to productivity. And if we can sort of step up the level of productivity in the economy, that will help us to not only boost revenues, which will translate into higher tax revenues and so on, but also help us manage costs much better. So if you look at, you know, the budget, there's about 100 billion that is allocated to government emoluments and pensions. And that's about 40% of the total government spend. So if we can enhance productivity, then probably we can help on both sides of the equation. One, to reduce our costs of operations, or, you know, the operating costs, and also to increase the revenue side of things.
Well, this is a very real issue because, as you point out, emoluments as a percentage of total expenditure is at 29.7% in 2017, up from 26.6% just last year. So that's a big jump. That's as much as about 3.5%, 4%. So a lot of the people that the private sector will not hire because they're just not good enough have been taken into the public sector. Now, that's concerning because it means there's a lot of, I hate to use this word, deadwood in the civil service. Now, from a structural standpoint, the country cannot take on too much deadwood because it will just drag the country down. Yinsen?
I think the government actually realised that.
Do they?
They realise that. However, there are also belief among the graduates today, Malaysian graduates that I know, they feel that it's the duty of the government to ensure that people have jobs, because young people, fresh graduates today, feel that you give me education, you should secure me with a job opportunity. And I think that is the fundamental mindset change that we need to instill in our people, meaning to say, if you're not good enough, you're going to get a job. So you have to be good.
Well, here's the point, because every year, the education sector takes up the biggest budget allocation. I think last year it was 50-odd billion. Not sure what it is this year, because nobody has done a ministry-by-ministry breakdown yet, but it must be at least there or thereabout. So do we need a complete revamp of the education sector?
I think it's a transformation journey. You know, you can't make those changes overnight. And we have started probably on the right track. Perhaps we could have started earlier, but, you know, these are things that are very difficult to sort of predict upfront. And, you know, trying to tailor the workforce better to meet the requirements of the economy is actually very crucial.
If I can just add in very quickly, I think it's also time for us to look into the P&L of all our public universities to see who is being efficient, who is not being efficient, but not only to look at the Ministry of Higher Education and then lump all the responsibility to the ministry. Because on one hand, academics and universities want to have the autonomy. On the other hand, they want to be beggars forever. I think you cannot have your cake and your pie and then you eat it as well. So I think structural change in terms of budgetary independence and also having our own academic autonomy, I think it will come hand in hand.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left, guys. So let's discuss things like the big ticket infra items like the Pangbourne Highway, the East Coast Highway, and of course the repairs done to the existing railways as well, which is going to cost upwards of 150 odd billion ringgit or so. Now, the concern among the ratings agencies, and I think the Fitches of this world and the Moody's of this world, especially Moody's, they have thrown doubts over the achievability of budget parity by 2020, specifically because of the income issues that we're discussing and the assumptions, as well as in the expense items. Because if these things are done and it's moved off balance sheet into the contingent liabilities framework, it's going to throw the numbers off kilter. Jagdeep, when you look at those items, do you think that perhaps the government is unrealistic in wanting to do these infrastructure projects without being able to afford it, essentially?
I mean, if you look at development expenditure, it has been growing, but at a very, very slow pace. And it is important for us to make sure that there is enough allocation to development, because you cannot just look at, you know, the operating side of things and take a short-term view of things. So putting more money into development is probably the right thing to do. But it's always, again, a balance. So there may be, we will definitely have to find ways how to look harder at reducing the operating expenditure and probably trying to shift a lot more into development expenditure over time.
I completely agree with that. Coming from Kelantan, I'm actually very happy to see development in the rural area, infrastructure given to rural areas as well, and not lump everything to capital cities.
Well, it's basically the accountability and the transparency of those projects.
And implementation.
Correct, because obviously construction is one of the easiest to pilfer from because of the large ticket sizes and the procurement process that comes along with it. Do you think there's been enough reform on this front, though?
Slowly, but not enough.
Jagdeep?
Yeah, it's a bit difficult to comment on that because I don't think there's a lot of data out there in terms of how this translates into cost savings and so on.
Correct. It's the asymmetry of information from what the government knows to what the public perceives, because we don't get all the information. Okay, one last point from each of you, I guess, with Budget 2017 unfolding. Do you think that this sets up the country well for the next 12 months from here on in? Jagdeep, let's end with you.
I'm actually excited with a couple of things. Maybe something that's maybe a little bit more shorter term or medium term is this concept of a digital free zone that was announced in the budget. Very little details at this point in time, but if you look back at when we introduced MSC, it definitely provided us a boost. The big names all came to Malaysia and so on. And I'm hoping that the digital free zone will help us provide that much needed boost to the economy in terms of shifting us towards what is current today.
Yinsen?
In terms of SME, I think SMEs will benefit a lot from the tax breaks. Another thing would be for Uber drivers and for people who can take up a second job. I think that's a new, very refreshing idea that the government is liberalising this sector, this sharing economy.
Okay, well, Ng Yin Sin, the Vice President of SANBET, the Reform Advocacy Group, and Jagdeep Singh, Tax Leader for PwC Malaysia. Thank you for joining us, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.